November 30th, 2008, it's the Watt from Pedro Show. So Watt from Pedro Show, day of the month, right?
Yeah,
right,
end of November.
Because this is a shorty. How do you remember that stuff?
There's some kind of rhyme. I just look at the calendar.
Good technique. Was there a miss today or what?
Yeah, a little
man,
foggy this morning.
I couldn't see Tayo at all. And then it was weirder than fog. It was like weird mist. Really, really white, not gray. I was pedaling in it. We started off with It's Easy to Remember by John Coltrane. And then we heard You're Not Blank, So Baby We're Through by the Dills, which brings up my guest here. Well, several guests we have. But the one I asked first is Tony Kinman.
Welcome.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Yeah, and Christy, his wife. And then we have some other usual suspects. It's just Peek.
Hi.
Taya. Now, you guys brought some side mice.
Side mice? My friend Paula and Morgan.
Right.
Hello.
In the corner.
Howdy. Taya.
I brought my friend Jeff.
Okay.
Welcome.
How's it going?
So, the Love Grotto.
Rockin'.
Packed. It says it on the bulkhead up there. Is it? Oh, there it is.
That's the old ceiling at the last
moved it.
Love Grotto. This has been more of restraint.
Yeah. So, played in Long Beach last night at Prospect.
It was packed, huh?
A lot of humanity. Maybe too much. Couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Pete and Jer played good, huh?
Is there such thing as too much humanity?
For the contained
sardine can
thing,
status.
Yeah. Maybe not. Maybe okay for a fire or some, you know, panic situation, earthquake. Maybe then it's good for something like that. But casually, what do you call it? Flitting, prancing, sauntering, sauntering. That was difficulty with sauntering.
No elbow room.
Or prancing. Prancing?
Yeah, no prancing.
Flitting about. You dig it when the pad's too packed. Does it, like, encumber the prancing?
Yeah. It goes in the way of the
jabbers. So that was a difficulty. I could see, you know, if there was a fire or earthquake. But Jeff Morris Tepper played, who did a couple albums with Beefheart, and that was pretty neat to see.
Cool.
Later day, Doc at the Radar Station, Ice Cream for Crow, and he had a pretty smoking band.
Yeah, we played with Morris Tepper.
Yeah.
Several months ago, they were really good.
Yeah, last time
really good.
It was a while ago.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it was on the Queen Mary?
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
The Deerhoof?
Yeah.
And it was more like a jug band. This was pretty more crazy. One time he called me. This is years ago, like after D-Boone got killed. And I was like, wow. Did you ever see Beefheart with him? Mm-hmm. I saw that whiskey gig, guys. My leg was in a cast. Anyway, he called me up, and I was like, wow, this would be a trippy cat to play with. And he said, no, that was all Captain Beefheart stuff, Don stuff. He says, you know, I want to do like Highway 61. You know, hear that big freight train coming down the track, and that'd be you, Watt. And I was like, no, man. Much respect to you, but I wanted something like Dipper Dirty Blue Jean. I ended up getting to do that song with Nels. Very difficult. Very difficult. I think it was the first song I recorded with that little bass I got. So. Tony.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can I ask you about how you got started with music?
Yeah.
Okay, how old were you?
I guess I was about 16, 17.
Yeah.
First actually picked something up. Always kind of been into it. But
you were listening to records?
Listened to a lot of records. I always listened to a lot of records when I was growing up. My parents liked music, and my older brother was in on, like, you know, the early 60s, from the 60s on, music.
You grew up around here, LA?
No, my father was in the service, and we traveled all over. So I probably, my first memory of you know, rock and roll is, aside from the, you know, rock and roll, maybe not the music your parents were listening to, but was in like North Carolina and hearing like the Beatles and the Beach Boys and stuff like that. And I was a kid, and
is that Fort Bragg?
No, it was actually a small town called Charlotte, North Carolina. We were living there when my father was stationed in Japan, and he was only gonna be there for a year. Well, that's where my mother's family was from.
Okay.
So we were staying near my grandmother, who lived in Charlotte, North Carolina, and listening to all of this music. And I know that at the time, my concept of cities and geography and where everything was that Florida was where the big cities were, because the biggest radio station that everybody listened to was, I think it was called WAPE out of Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, that's a big Navy town.
And it blanketed all the southern part of the eastern seaboard, and that's where we were listening to most of the songs from, out of. And so, yeah, that...
What was the call letters?
I think WAPE, I think they called the Ape, the Big Ape. That's what they called themselves.
Yeah, because the three-letter ones are Clear Channel ones, and they go far, like San Francisco KGO.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday with the Motorcycle. So, you're listening to the radio, and that gets you wanting to get records?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually go out and buy records, because I never really had any money until I got a little older and would get paper routes and stuff like that, and then I remember my first single was a Doors record, a Doors 45 called, it was Tell All the People, Follow Me, yeah. And
45s too, those were my first records.
Yeah, yeah. I think back then it was probably everybody, because they didn't cost much.
No.
And back then they would have like usually cool pictures on them. And I would buy in records, then started wanting to play a little bit later.
Did you know anybody who played?
No, I didn't. And so Chip and I kind of got our first instruments at the same time.
Chip's your brother.
Yeah, Chip is my brother. And my partner up until very recently throughout all the years of doing this. And actually, I did know some people. We knew some ukulele players when we lived in Hawaii.
Wow. Who,
like, well, they, you know.
School?
No, they were friends of my parents. Like, come over, like, at parties and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay.
And they were pretty good. And, I mean, thinking back on it, I had nothing to make a, you know, compare them to at the time. But they would, you know, whip out the ukuleles at parties and stuff like that and start going for it. So that was cool. But those were the only people that I really knew. Aside from doing in high school, you know, like orchestra or marching bands.
Oh, you tried that?
I did it. I didn't try it.
I tried it for 10 weeks on a clarinet. They put me on clarinet and they told me to.
If you would have been taller, they would have put you on baritone saxophone.
I tried to get on sax, like with the other 20, 30 guys. And
yeah.
I got the clarinet. His name was Mr. Luna. I've told this story a bunch of times. But he says, "Why, you try hard, but you ain't got it, man."
So when is that finally going to sink in?
I never took another music class to school again. So, you know, thank God I met Deep Boone, you know.
Yeah, I was
crushed by that. What do you call that? Institutional educational experience?
Yeah.
Assessment
of...
A lot of those decisions are made like that. The counselor, you know, spoke to me in seventh grade. Your pop's Navy, huh? And you scored so much on this test. Well, we're going to put you in an electric shop every year so just learn how to fix TVs. Crazy. By the time I graduated, nobody's fixing TVs. I had to put myself through college, take all the classes I should have had in high school.
Oh, really?
The counselor thing has a lot of sway. Anyway, back to you. You took the music. You played in the band. What'd you play?
I played baritone saxophone.
Oh, wow. Jerry Mulligan.
No. Well, this is a marching band, so you're basically playing tuba parts. Boom, 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 boom. Which came in handy when Wreck and File started. But
when you bought your first instrument, what was it, a guitar?
It was a bass.
Wow, in those days, too.
Yeah, it was a Tysco bass. You know,
Yeah, I remember those, Tesco.
Yeah, like $29.
Really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
They had $14 guitars at the Thrifty, hanging on a tree.
Yeah.
Metal trees, yeah.
No, and I got that, and I got a...
What made you think about bass? Did you know what bass was?
Yeah, I just always liked it.
Oh, because the school orchestra.
Well, no, yeah, but not that.
Probably a cat was playing double bass.
No, we didn't have a double. No, our school orchestra wasn't big enough.
It's a marching band.
Well, they probably doubled up, right?
But in orchestra, I played viola.
Which is kind of a bigger violin.
It's a bigger violin, yeah. There's the violin, the viola, then the cello, which is actually the bass, and then the double bass, which is,
right.
You know, and, but I played that, but I actually got the bass guitar before that and was messing around with that with my brother. And I got to learn how to play bass with the Ventures, the big blue Moss Wright bass on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was neat. It was
the bass parts are missing.
Yeah, it was a 33 and a third album, and it had a... what you later realized was type of tablature on the thing, where and they had a touch of really simple stuff like Chuck Berry stuff.
Yeah.
You know, or no, Chuck Berry was the last piece you worked up to. The first stuff was really simple. I mean, really simple, like bass notes to like some folk songs. It was very cool, though.
Did you ever see any gigs? Like concerts?
Like bands?
Yeah, at this time.
The first band I ever saw was a real rock band. It was when I was a kid, and this was in South Carolina. And there was a band that was playing a picnic called the Malibu. And the band in South Carolina was called the Malibus. They were a California-style
surf
band.
Yeah, Fenders.
Fenders, yeah, and that's the first.
I'm tilted back.
Yeah, that was the first band I ever actually remember seeing. And,
wow! Did you look at the bass player?
I don't remember actually looking at anything except just being dazzled by it all. Because I always thought bands were dazzling, especially when bands were actually cared about the way they looked. You know, back then.
What were they wearing?
They were wearing suits. I think they were wearing blazers,
and probably like Beatles.
Maybe even white Levi's or something. Kind of a surf, you know, combination type thing.
There's a beach in South Carolina. Were you by the shore?
Yeah.
It gets sweaty. There's some bugs.
It's swampy. Too. Yeah, it's not like out here. It's swampy. Yeah.
Oh man, I went paddling. I was on tour once and played Charleston. You've been there, very pretty town.
Yeah.
Because it didn't get burned. And so it looks kind of like New England, older. And there's canals from plantation days. And, these cats took me paddling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no gators. Lucky. That was neat. But man, the bugs come up. Wow.
Yeah, a lot of bugs there.
A couple hundred years ago. So the big houses would be way inland.
Yeah, those shipping barons had their big pads there in Charleston.
Yeah, Charleston's got that big custom house. And, of course, Fort Sumter, where the party began. But it's a neat town. I think Shepherd Fairey's from there. You know the artist, the old big guy?
Mm-hmm.
So you get this bass, you got an amp.
Yeah.
Like a little...
Yeah, that was instantly fuzzed and distorted when you plugged in, you know, because there was no power to it. Yeah.
Well, you were playing in the bedroom, probably.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Chip gets a guitar.
Yeah.
And will you stop copying records?
We never actually got really good enough to copy records. We simply couldn't figure them out. I can figure out bass parts because you put on. Like a whole lot of love, and it's like it's one string. Then you turn your amp up a little bit, and it's like, it sounds almost like the record, did it? But Chip's whole thing was that, and I think this is one of the reasons why we got into punk rock was perfect. Was that he would take he was totally into people like Mick Ronson and stuff like that, and he would try to learn a solo, and he would get like three or four notes, and he couldn't get like the other 75 or 100 notes of the thing. So he would sort of work around those. And he would have, and he would give like an abbreviated, condensed version of what the real lead was. So we learned pretty on that when we would do other people's songs, like the garage band I ended up playing with in high school, Chip and I both, when we would do other people's songs before we ever started writing our own, like we would do some New York Dolls songs, we would do some Who songs and stuff like that. But for the most part, we would really have to come up with brand new arrangements because we simply could not play what the bands in high school, the people actually wanted to play at their parties, they could do that. There was a band called Bondo, B-O-N-D-O.
Yeah, it's stuff you use to repair a car.
Yeah, and they were...
when you buy a used car, you take a magnet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the magnet won't stick in there.
It's plastic
Bondo
filler. Yeah, but they were called Bondo, and...
some kind of plastic synthetic bonding... Hence the name, maybe.
Yeah, and these guys could play like Bad Company.
Yeah,
they could play Led Zeppelin. They could play all that stuff perfect. And they had I can't remember his name now, but the one guy who was the guitar player, he went by one name, and he was basically a stoner, like a surfer stoner guy.
Yeah.
But he could do any of that Jeff Beck stuff, any of that stuff, any Jimmy Page, all of those guys. And those, and that was the hot band. That was a really, really hot band.
That's how it was in Pedro.
Yeah, and
copy good, you were the
yeah,
band.
And we were awful. We couldn't do it. We couldn't play like that. And it was and so, you know, we basically were doing like kind of, you know, versions of like a New York Dolls song or Iggy. Or we did tried to learn some stuff off of Raw Power and stuff like that. And we could get closer to that because it wasn't real flash stuff. But still, you know, it was difficult. And plus it was me and Chip and our high school friend named Jeff, who was in the Hitmakers later.
Oh, wow.
That was our high school thing, and we couldn't find any drummers because drummers would come and play with us for a while, but then they knew we were crap. And they didn't want to. Drummers were always like that. And even in my experience was that even in the punk rock days, drummers were the last musicians to kind of start coming around because they didn't want to play, you know.
It was difficult too, the practice pads. Like you can play in a bedroom.
Yeah.
Just turn down the amps. Drummers mm-hmm. got to have a pad, a garage.
Yeah, but even then, the drummers that were around didn't want to play with us because we were crappy. Yeah. So we always ended up getting... playing with crappy drummers or playing with good drummers for like twice and then they wouldn't want to play with us anymore.
We played with D Boone's little brother, so
uh-huh.
kind of came with the deal, and we would figure out records, but it would be all the wrong parts.
Yeah
our ears were just terrible, couldn't fathom it, but we had no notion of writing your own songs. Do you remember the first song you wrote?
I think one of the... God, I can't remember the exact first song. Yeah, I do remember the first song I wrote. It was horrible. I can't remember the name of it now, but I do remember some of the music that went into it. It was pretty awful.
I only wrote one song my whole teen years. Mm-hmm. It was called Mr. Bass King of Outer Space. And it was about... this guy does a bass solo at a gig and blows the rest of the band off.
Blows them off the stage. Yes.
Yeah, and some issues with the bass man. Because here there was a real big thing about bass being where you put the lame guy. That's what I loved, the idea you pick bass. Mm-hmm. As it usually would be guitar players who couldn't find a gig anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was that. It's that
I got into it because D Boone's ma said, "You're going to play bass."
Uh-huh.
She wanted us to have a band. Because
uh-huh.
projects, I mean, it wasn't a lot of guns. It was the early 70s, but she wanted us in the house after school.
Uh-huh.
So, you're going to be on the bass. D Boone guitars, brother Joe on drums. And, yeah, we do the Smoke on the Water riff for like hours. Must have drove her crazy, but she... knew where we were.
Uh-huh.
Not get in trouble. So, D Boone didn't write songs either. There was just no culture of it. in town here, all the guys who could really play just copied other people. Mm-hmm.
Well, back then there wasn't even a call for it, really. I know sometimes when you talk to, you know, you tell the story of the old day, the very beginning, the dawn of punk rock, you know, and there wasn't any place to play any original music, you know, music of your own. There just simply wasn't. All the clubs in L.A. didn't, you know.
Oh, L.A. But
even back down where we were, it was the same. I remember that when, after we got stuff sorted out for ourselves and started writing our own songs and actually put together something that we felt that we're ready to go on stage now and at least give a passable presentation of what we want to be, in the sense that if somebody comes to see us, and even if they hate it, we'll be able to go, well, what they hated was us, you know, what our music. It wasn't like a crappier it wasn't a crappy version of something that we thought we might have been. You know, after we reached a point where we're kind of going, okay, we're ready to be what we are, you know.
What'd you call the band?
It was the Dills.
Right away.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you get that name?
Made it up.
Yeah, of course.
And
like kind of, no, what went into it?
No, nothing.
You just throwing around letters?
Yeah. We would always sit around and make up band names.
Yeah.
And
so Dills?
Yeah. And
is there Dill Pickle in front of him?
No, never. Now see, that would have been dumb. I mean, it's bad enough to name yourself the Dills, but the thing is to say, well, why did it come from?
It has no source.
No, we got
it. Talking in tongues and another dude grabbed
just
it.
Snatch it out.
Yeah. Big list, you're making lists out, and how did it come up? Yahtzee, Scrabble, things.
There's no method, you can take it out there.
Law school guy, you get the Dills, yeah.
That'll work.
There was no process?
No.
Who takes credit?
Me?
You.
Yeah, or the blame,
you
right?
You probably know a little more than that.
That's what you say, ask Tony, when people ask the question. But we would get gigs probably like, you know, get some connections, like, the high school, you know, that we'd gone to and said, like, you know, because we knew that every once in a while they would have bands play during lunch, and we would go, you know, call up an old teacher or something, or somebody who was a year younger than us, who was now a senior, you know, and say, could you
get us at lunchtime?
Yeah, you know, you're the chairman of the entertainment. Yeah, well, yeah, it'd be great. And it was always the same. It was like you got about a minute and a half into it, then literally, we played we got a gig playing a German restaurant, because you couldn't get into clubs to play.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you
yeah.
played places like, you know, conned your school into it, or a German restaurant. We once played a pizza joint in Garden Grove.
Well, by this time you've moved out here.
No, this is all kind of like leading, yeah, it was all like leading up to this thing. We were still living in Carlsbad.
Hey, Bob. Oh, yeah, but you make the move from, because you went, this the high school's in Carlsbad.
Oh, yeah, this stuff was still going on in Carlsbad. I played at German Earth, the same thing. It was like, bam. So you reached a point where, like, you were just wondering what it would be like when you finally got through your first song. But, you know, but that's just what was happening there. There was no place to go through now. I mean, even now, the most inept, crappiest thing will at least probably usually get a chance to play at least once somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, give here's who we are, here's what we're doing. But back then it was just a struggle even to get that. There simply wasn't much of a place to
play. So we're talking like 74, 75?
Yeah, or even like 75, 76.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you hear about the mask.
No. What happened to us is that we moved up to San Francisco. From Carlsbad, we moved to San Francisco. Yeah, because the Jeff, who was the Dill still had a lead singer. It was Jeff, and we had a drummer named Joseph. And they. We moved up to San Francisco. We ended up staying there like a couple of months. We played one gig up there, but we met the nuns and those guys, and got hit the mabuhay. We came back, and we moved back to Carlsbad. Jeff quit, and Joe the drummer quit, and Chip and I got our my best friend from high school, Andre. We made him our drummer.
Yeah.
And that's...
You know, I've seen a picture of the four-man Dills. Brendan Mullen had it. You know about this?
No, uh-uh.
Do you remember taking a picture for the band, a promo picture?
Yeah, we had pictures, yeah.
And some outfits.
I don't recall the outfits we were wearing.
Kind of girly, a little bit. Maybe Mick Ronson...
Thanks. Oh, yeah, Chip. Yeah, Chip was like that, not me. I'll blame that on Chip.
I shouldn't say girly.
I should say anti-hetero.
Maybe not so convinced of that.
Non-Pedro.
It was wild. He had this picture. I don't know how he got it. Did you remember Flo and him on? Brendan Mullen was the cat who ran the mask.
No. I never met Brendan until after all these times. So
okay. He had this picture. He pulled it out from a drawer in the lingerie once. He says, "You got to see this one." I couldn't believe it.
Are you sure it was us?
Oh, yeah. You don't remember taking this promo picture?
Oh, no, we took pictures back then.
The four-man.
Yeah, but I don't know how they would have been called girly, because I don't recall that at all.
I called it girly. I shouldn't have said that. Because, you know, I thought that's how you made music, you know. Alice Cooper, I never wondered about his name, and New York Dolls and all that. I'd say girly now. In those days, I'd say rock and roll, because it seemed like that's what rock and roll people did. Or Fogerty with flannel. You know, they had outfits.
Yeah.
And so I didn't mean it. In a pejorative way.
Sure.
No, I didn't. I was full into that stuff. But it was a lot different than the three-man Dills. That's what...
Yes, very much, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have recordings of those days?
I know there are recordings. I don't have any. Because we actually did go in to record two or three songs.
So this band that you just start with, Chip, ends up being the band you start doing gigs. There's no in-between bands.
No, there's not.
Wow.
No, there's not. Because, I mean, back in high school, it was like an isolation. You know, if you, there weren't that many people who liked the same bands or liked the same things. And so, the other band I was describing where all these guys could really play and stuff like that. This is, I mean, bands like Grand Funk Railroad and Black Sabbath, ruled my high school. Bad Company and stuff like that. And I was into, Led Zeppelin and stuff like that, but I didn't really like those other bands. And that was, you know, I liked the Dolls. And I liked the old stuff. I liked the Kinks and things like that.
Yeah, which was considered old music.
It was. I mean, it was old music
back
then.
People ask me about young people these days and how open-minded they are and how closed-minded it was in our days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, stuff like Kinks was called old music.
Well, plus back then, too, it was all still... It hadn't started cycling yet. It was still...
Like you said, parents... Rock and roll, not your parents' music. Nowadays,
it is.
You can't talk to a kid like that. All their parents.
Nowadays it is. I've a lot of the people that I knew back then have kids now. I mean, they have kids that are grown up basically now. But I remember seeing them with the kid. You know, they buy their kids like a little kid sized Ramones T-shirt.
Yeah.
And it's just you kind of. And my parents never put me in a Perry Como T-shirt, you know, or anything like that. But then it's like, oh, I want to make sure my kid likes cool music, and it's like,
that's way different.
Yeah, why?
I remember when I first started touring, I met people that actually their parents were hippies.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody whose parents were hippies.
Me either. Me either.
You know, but our generation is.
Yeah.
That's quite a trip.
Yeah, but the. But anyway, but back then the music hadn't really started cycling in the sense that you still had Elvis, then everything that came before Elvis, and Elvis Beatles. And Chuck Berry and that whole thing, then the Beatles, yeah. And then the King, stuff like that. So there was still a, it was still, there was still a, what's the word for it? There was still like a linear movement happening, yeah. You know, which has stopped now, and now everything's, it's folded back on itself and everything else. Right, so right. Now it's, I mean, I've got a friend of mine who's, he's a lot younger than me, and he was telling me that he saw that movie, The Darjeeling Express, and which one with all the Kinks music in.
God,
that's
weird. I just saw that last night.
Yeah, and that's how he got hip to the Kinks. He had never heard of the Kinks before. He liked the music he was hearing, and this guy's like 22 years old. And so, yeah, I watched the credits. And I saw it was by this band called the Kinks, and so I Googled them, and he did the thing, and then he went out and got all their stuff. And he's a huge Kinks fan now. Yeah, and that's
the young people. They're open minded to that, and plus information's yeah, but it, a lot
and easier. And the music's brand new. You know, I mean, it's not like if he goes to see Ray Davies now, he's kind of go, okay, that's that guy's pretty old. But the music still.
Yeah, I don't think kids bum on old like they did.
I was going to say. I remember I saw that Woodstock movie. That much of a difference now.
And you know, as a kid, it just came out. Yeah. And when Sha Na Na comes out, everybody started booing. It's like, what is my dad's music? Fuck this shit. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it was only like 10, 15 years old at the most.
Yeah.
Now, like, a young person listening to 35, 40 year old Black Sabbath, no problem.
Yeah. Well, but actually, I don't think except in black music there hasn't been that sort of the sequence is over. There is no real innovations in sound or cinema in attitude maybe a little bit, because I think music's gotten a lot more cynical. I think the sense of irony has gotten leadened. It doesn't work anymore, because if it's all ironic, then it's not ironic anymore. And I think I just noticed that when I hear a lot of stuff that's being done these days, and I hear it, and the sounds will be good. I like the sounds of a lot of music nowadays, but the minute the singing starts, I just go, sit down and shut up. You know, I've heard this all before. Not in the sense that it's a repetition, it's just the attitude is always the same. And when you go back and you listen to some older stuff where somebody either sounds sincere or is faking it really well, it's makes your ears stand up.
Yeah,
mine at least. Yeah. You know, even if they're screaming.
Well, speaking of irony, okay, you're trying to do these gigs.
Yeah.
And this punk scene comes out. And how'd you hear about it? You moved to San Francisco before you heard of it? I read about
it. Well, when we moved to San Francisco, I'm actually trying to think now where. Okay, Chip subscribed to Rock Scene magazine.
Rock Scene, yeah.
And we saw pictures of the Ramones before we ever heard them. Before the record was ever got made, you know, it's like they had the pictorials of Ramones by a guitar, you know, and stuff like that. And it was, I think Ruxin came along a little too late to get at the height of the Dolls thing, but they, at the tail end of the Red Leather Dolls, when the Dolls were managed by McLaren and they were doing the Red Leather
tour.
Yeah, there was a couple of photo spreads from that thing.
Well, they came out here and did a Don Kirshner taping.
Yeah, but that was when they were
before Malcolm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you go to that?
Yeah. Is that they were at the Long Beach Auditorium.
See, I saw them play at JJ's in San Diego.
Wow.
That was the first real rock concert I ever went to was the
Oh, you never went to Arena Rock?
No. But that wasn't real, because I didn't. I went to two arena shows. I saw, I think I just went there with my friends because I wasn't into these bands. I saw Allman Brothers.
Yeah, I heard of them.
It was a nightmare. It was an endless. It was endless. It was endless wank. And I saw. Even though I like some of their tunes when I listen to them on a record now, but I saw them live and they were heinous. And I saw Black Sabbath with Yes opening for them.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Fish. Chris Squire playing The Fish. It was awful. I mean, it was horrible. And I was kind of going, and it just wasn't any fun. And years later, I went to see Chip said, oh, let's go see Motley Crue at the Forum or something. It was the same thing, you know, because once you get that sort of Nuremberg thing happening with the giant gatherings and all that stuff, it's my own particular taste is that I don't, you know, it's there's nothing you could touch or really feel. But so the Dolls was the actual first band I saw that I had their record. And I loved them. I loved them. I wanted to see them. These other bands, like the Arena stuff, I didn't want to see those bands. I just went because it's like tickets with my friends.
I'm thinking Dolls, Dills.
Uh-oh. No, there was no connection. But that is a good. I'll take that explanation.
Okay, let's listen to some more music.
We read the paper, then we picked the show.
Watt from Pedro Show. That was My Enduring Brilliance by The Pity Fur. The Pity Fur. Is that a name? Three words. THEPITYFUR.
Pity the Fur?
No. The Pity Fur.
A Pity for your
The Pity the Fur.
Here.
That's a cool name. I like that name.
Now, does it, do you ponder the origin?
No. I think it's just that incongruous wordplay creates some good names.
Maybe it's some kind of toupee.
The fur.
Then we heard something live from the Dills, Mr. Big. You know what gig that was?
No. No, I don't know. Because the way a lot of that stuff gets released is that Chip and I had a long we would get the Dills only made three 45s, two with two songs traditional and one with three songs on it. So we had that's eight or seven songs released total that were actually recorded in a studio.
Yeah, I'm gonna get to that. I want to talk about your recording.
No, and over the years, what would happen is that we would get these up. People who would come up and they would say, well, do you mind if I press it up and release it? And we said, no, just be honest that on the liner notes, you know, with whatever it is, you know, you have our blessing. Here's the name of our publishing company. You know, if you sell any, you know, be sure to do the right thing, even if it's only like 45 cents, just to be honest. And, send us a copy just so we can have one. And somewhere on the cover, make sure that somebody's interested in buying it is going to be able to see that this was recorded on a cassette at a live show. So just so they'll know what they're going to get. So that
You mean the quality?
Yeah.
Caveat emptor.
Yeah, and but we
if you don't know where, then obviously they didn't put that information on this one. Is off a CD called
Class War. It was released on Dionysus about 4 years ago.
Which is Lee Joseph. That's his name.
That's right. Yeah.
Lee Joseph. Good cat. Put that out. And but maybe some is from that the live thing that What Records put out. Maybe.
Or What Records is from a similar source that they put out. Yeah.
And then we heard Chip Kimmon and PCH with Lady Bird. Now this is a new band your brother has. I played with them last week at Mr. T's Bowl. It's really good. You've told me there's other versions. I guess this is the latest version, seeing it was a week ago.
Oh, PCA? No, well, this is. I think this is the definitive version of the band.
Okay, yeah, they're good. I liked it. And then we started off with Amanda Ruth by Rank and File. We're going to get to Rank and File, but I still want to explore some of these Dills because this is your early days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not playing the Tesco bass in the Dills, are you?
No.
Right?
No.
You're playing...
I was playing the Thunderbird.
You got a Thunder. That's your second base.
No. I went through between the Tesco and the Thunderbird. I had a my first real base, which was it was a fairly well built instrument. Was a Ibanez version of a EBO but with a long scale neck, and it had a slotted head,
like an EB3.
Yeah.
Pickups.
Yeah, and it was long scale, and that was a real one. And then my first real bass was a Rickenbacker 4000, the single pickup that I can testify are very well built instruments.
I think Costa Mesa they built.
Yeah, well, I know because at the time I got that bass while I was still in a band with the lead singer.
The Dills had four people.
Yeah, and
Jeff, what's he doing now?
I don't know what Jeff's doing now, but...
Hey, Jeff.
I don't know what I'm doing
Tony
now.
Tony says I.
But they had but we had some beef at some rehearsal like that, and I threw my bass at him.
Whoa.
And he ducked, and it bounced off the wall, and a little chip off the pick guard. Besides that, it was pick it up and play it.
Wow.
Which is unusual. You don't think of Rickenbackers like that, but this one
they're
was
strong.
Amazed. Yeah.
The neck goes through the body. It's all maple.
Yeah,
they're strong basses.
Yeah, and then after that, I got my Thunderbird, which was the bass I really wanted all along. Yeah.
Oh, really? Because Killer Kane had one.
Kane had one. It Whistle played one for a while. Over in Watts, Montelupo played one. They were just really cool looking.
He also had boots up to here.
Yeah, right. And his hair was dyed silver.
Yeah, right.
When he was young.
Yeah. Don't have to do that anymore.
And
but he had boots up to his thighs.
Yeah, and that's the bass I had throughout the whole day.
You know, Ronnie told me when Ig was doing Raw Power, they had them cats come and try to be the rhythm section.
Didn't work. That's why the Ashton Brothers got called.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What, over in Watson Buffin, the drummer from Mott the Hoop?
Buffin, yeah.
So sometimes that doesn't work.
They were trying all these cats over there, and finally Ig said, let's call the Ashton Brothers.
Yeah. But that would have made sense, though, right?
Yeah. So you get this Thunderbird. You're up in San Francisco. You're doing some gigs. Well, I heard you saw some pictures in Rock Scene. And then you hear about this Mabuhay on Broadway, right?
No. We had seen... We played the Mabuhay before we ever heard of the Mabuhay. We played up there with the four-piece. It was just the play. When we got up to San Francisco, we were absolutely clueless about anything. Yeah. We thought we were going to go up there, and it was going to be like, you know, the Monkees or the Beatles in Help. You know, we were all going to live in one place.
Yeah.
And we were so good that we'll just get gigs and just be a band and all live together.
Did you have a manager?
No, we didn't have anything. Okay, we had nothing. We had no money. We didn't have a clue.
Yeah, but some bands get managers.
No.
You know, Gary Floyd, he lives up in San Francisco now. He's in this band, The Dicks.
Yeah, he was in the Big... He was in the Dicks. The Dicks, yeah.
Big Boys was buddies of theirs in Austin, but he moved to San Francisco. He told me they had this thing called Fake Band, where you get your band together and shit, and you don't even practice, but you put flyers up.
Yeah.
You don't have any gigs, you don't have anything, but, you know, you have like a presence.
Yeah.
You know, songs you've never jammed together.
Well, see, we were the opposite of that. We thought we were real, but we didn't have any of the other stuff. We didn't have any flyers. We didn't have a press. We didn't have anything.
But you got this gig at the Ness?
No. What ended up happening was how do we get that gig? I think it was through the Nuns, I think, because we were walking around looking for... We were just walking around town one day, and we saw this Nuns poster, and it looked really... It looked like something like out of the Stooges, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the hair and the kind of the attitude in the photograph and the weird name and all this stuff. So we went to the place where they were advertised to play, and we got there, and they said... And the place... It was a coffee shop or something, or a little bar, said, no, there's no gig tonight. I'm not going to let those guys play something like that. But they had stuck up a little handwritten notice and thing saying, gig canceled. Come see us at... And they went to the rehearsal space and said, left a note saying, come and see us play our rehearsal space. So we went there. And they were great. They were very, like, the Stooges and... very like Raw Power Stooges. The songs were great. The sound was great. And I think that we just chatted and... It was like, do you guys have a band too? And back then it was like, we were like some of the only people who came to their gig. We have a band too. And so, oh great, we have another gig in a few weeks. Why don't you guys play with us?
Yeah.
And... So we did, and I think that's the way we got that gig. And it was like a wreck.
But did you get more than one song out?
Yeah, we got to play our entire show, but it was like...
Was that your first full gig?
It was our first full gig, and that was enough to know, especially Chip and I, to know this isn't working. Because, you know, we were writing...
Because before that, you could blame it on the situation, right?
Yeah, hey,
that
yeah.
Got a
yeah,
shot.
Man, it was just incredible when we finally played. Well, we finally did get to play, and we realized that it's not working with Jeff and Joseph, the drummer. Mm. And they didn't like the songs Chip and I were writing, and it showed, and it wasn't the kind of gig that, you know... at the end of it, you're going to go, wow, we're really onto something. It was the kind of gig where at the end of it, you kind of go, me and Chip were kind of going, this doesn't work. And those guys were going, your songs suck. And so it was like a mutual sort of part. So we actually went back to Carlsbad.
After that gig.
It was a traumatic
yeah. experience.
Well, we'd run out of money, you know, and Monkees and Help, it was over, yeah. You know. It was like, this is, right. You know, and
what the game,
and
woke up.
And it wasn't like there was 400 people there who were going, after we played, going, yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah, let's go for it. And so we actually did get a little write up in a paper called Cyclone. It was like a little 1.5 minute mention of the us.
Yeah.
But it was really ambivalent. It wasn't like a good write up, but it wasn't bad. But it was enough to keep you going. You're kind of going, what?
Yeah.
Anyway,
these two guys.
Yeah. So we went back to Carlsbad, parting the ways with me and Chip and Jeff and Joseph.
Here, let's cut it there, because okay. We're at the end of the first hour.
Okay.
Hold tight for hour two, November 30th, 2008, Watt from Diderot Show. November 30th, 2008, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show, and we continue with Tony Kinman and other guests here. But, Tony, more about Dill. So,
okay,
the Help movie's over. You're coming back to Carlsbad.
Okay, we got back to Carlsbad, parting the ways with Jeff and Joseph. And
people should know about Carlsbad. It's kind of down San Diego way.
Yes, it's just south of Oceanside,
and right by the Marine Base, Pendleton.
Yeah, well, my dad. That's how we ended up there. My dad got stationed in Camp Pendleton and retired, and loved Southern California. Decided to retire there. And anyway, we went down there. Jeff and Joseph parting the ways. We got my buddy, high school best friend Andre to play drums with us. Said, you're going to play drums. And he took the name of Buddy Hate for Buddy Love, like Buddy Love and the original Nutty Professor. Said, yeah, he was going to be Buddy Hate. And we made a trip or two back to San Francisco with Andre. Buddy.
Well, that reminds me.
Yeah.
How old were you at this time?
This would have been 21, 22.
Because you have this, you had a different name too.
Tony 19. Yeah.
So you must have got that name a couple years before.
Yeah. Anyway. And your counselor said you'd never amount to anything. People
used to think me and D. Boone's names were fake.
Watt and Boone?
Yeah. D. Boone, Daniel Boone. It might be like light bulb or something.
Right. And, okay, so we were still living in Carlsbad, fishing around for gigs, you know, back up in the city. And that's when we got the call to do the Cheech and Chong thing. And we did that.
There's a movie called Up in Smoke.
Yes.
First Cheech and Chong movie, and there's a thing that they're going to play the Roxy, and the opening band
is.
I heard the Germs tried out for it and lost.
Oh no, they were all. There was a lot of bands that played that day. We were the only ones they used, as it turned out.
But it's like you're not doing a song. It's like you're tuning up or something.
No, it was really weird. We got up there. We weren't even supposed to be in it. It was an accident, us getting in on that show, because everything else was scheduled. Peter Urban was our manager at the time.
Ah, so you do have a manager.
No, by this time we did have a manager, but not the first time up in San Francisco. Peter called us up, and Peter was a manager the way Buddy Hate was our drummer. He was like...
Just a buddy.
Buddy. Yeah, well, I'll be your manager. Okay.
Right.
And he called up and he said, they're doing a move. Ronnie Bingenheimer mentioned the Dills. He said, hey... Rodney on his radio show said, you know, Cheech and Chong are filming this thing. Everybody's going to be there. Hey, maybe the Dills should try to play. And I think it was a joke. I think he was joking. And Peter Urban got on the phone and said, hey, you guys come up here now, you know.
Wow.
And let's try to do this. And we said, why? And he said, just come on up. So we went, we picked him up. He lived over on Argyle Street. We picked him up, drove to, I think they filmed at the Roxy or the Whiskey.
Yeah,
or something.
I think it was the Roxy.
And
Argyle's where the cafe was.
Yeah, we literally pulled up The guy, I guess the AD or something, whoever it was, walked out the door and said, "Who's next?" Peter literally opened the door and said, "We are." The guy said, "What's the name of the band?" "The Dills." And we went in on stage. We went in. They came and did some filmmaking blab at us for a few seconds. Like, okay, this, that, and the other. Do this. Don't stop. When we say go, go. We set up our stuff, and Andre, who was not a player, he was
this
just
is
like
his first gig with you.
I think we'd done a few others, and but still, it was foreign to him.
Yeah.
It was like, and so we, you know, we're sitting around getting ready to go, and all of a sudden the guy goes, "Go." And Chip goes like, "What?" And he goes, "Go, you're on." And so we played whatever it is we played, and it was like 45 seconds later, Andre's, I think Chip had broken strings, and Andre had pushed his, messed up his drum kit really bad. And that was it. And Andre signaled like, "Stop, my drums are messed up." And that was it. And that was, we were off. And it made it in the movie.
It's really just, it's not like a coherent song.
No, it's not like, "And here's the band play." It's just some garble.
It's like an opening act. You kind of gather because he's going to come on in the tutu and do.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so I don't know.
It's about a lot of mota. Like really? They end up with a truck.
Yeah, made of mota.
Really?
Yeah. Right, and the pig pulls him over and wants to eat hot dogs because it lights on fire. It's too much like a movie.
Mama talking to me, trying to tell me how to live.
Yeah, right. Which was a song on that album. With the movie was about working bits in from their stage show and their album. Uh-huh. But you guys are in it. I thought that was quite a coup.
Yeah, thanks.
So anyway, so you start doing gigs. When do you record that What single?
We record the What single after...
Because that song we play at the beginning of the show,
we
on one side and I Hate the Rich on the
other. Well, we were friends with the Zeros.
Yeah.
We'd made friends with the Zeros.
Who were like Chula Vista?
Yeah, Chula Vista. So it was
National City?
Yeah, it was the same, not close, but you know, all further, you know,
really
further
young
south.
Cats, so.
Yeah, and I think, except for Javi, I think they were all still in high school.
Yeah.
Maybe Robert Lopez was had just gotten out. But
he ended up moving to San Francisco too.
Yeah, and they had just put out Wimp on Bomb, they were going to put Wimp out on Bomb, and Javi played it for us. And we said, "Wow, it's really cool that it's a great sound." And we said, "Where'd you record?" And he gave us the name of the place they recorded it, which was down there. And I don't know if we had talked to Chris Ashford from Watt Records, and I don't know if he said, I'll release a single of you, or if we were going to record one and then get somebody to release it. I kind of think it was that way because we didn't have any sort of... If we talked to Chris, he probably would have given us like $100 to make it, but as it was, we made it for like $50.
First time in the studio?
With the Dills, yeah. To make a real record that we knew people were going to actually hear. And so, so we went down there, and like this bored hippie was basically said, "You got the money? Yeah, set up and play." And so we did, and we did two songs, and we were in and out of there really quick, and... and then we give it to Chris Ashford and he put it out.
Yeah.
And that's when, and after that, that's when we moved to San Francisco.
Okay.
In the meantime, we moved to San Francisco because Andre, Buddy Haight, wanted to go back to school. So we had a very friendly parting of the ways. We went up to San Francisco and...
Found a new drummer.
Yeah, got John Silvers. We actually auditioned some drummers down here. And then, we moved to San Francisco and got him up there. And then we started playing regularly up there and actually became whatever the Dills were. That's where we became whatever we were once we moved.
Well,
up
later
there.
You make a Danger House record.
Yeah, we do a Danger House record down here.
So,
which was actually before. I'm sorry, Danger House we recorded before John Silver. That's right. We recorded Danger House when we were still there with Rand McNally. Who was part of Danger House, whose real name was Pat Garrett. Which, why do you change your name from Pat Garrett to Ray McNally?
Everybody was changing names.
Yeah, but Pat Garrett's a pretty cool
yeah,
name.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
He's got Billy the Kid.
Yeah. And,
he played drums on that, and I think Gaza produced it.
I don't know if Gaza produced it.
No?
Because I'm pretty sure if Gaza had produced it, he would have taken credit.
It's not on there?
No. Because he was already, you know, getting credit for producing stuff. I don't think he did. He was mixed up
with a lot of those cats.
Yeah, but I don't recall. I don't recall.
The sound is so much different than the first record.
Yeah, well, our sound was always changing. The Dills were only together for. The Dills as from I Hate the Rich to.
It's not worth it.
Yeah, it's not worth it. Our sound was always changing because it was not for any calculating reason, because there were no calculations to be made. It was just whatever we felt like is what we did. In fact, I remember Chip and I having a big discussion a few months before the deal split up, where he was it's when hardcore was starting to come in.
Yeah.
And everything was getting really fast and you know, like that. And Chip said, "We gotta, you know, we really should, you know, start
playing faster
and harder again and all that stuff." And I said, I don't feel that. I mean, if I write a song where that's what it is, that'll be fine. I said, but I said I don't. That's not what we're doing. And then, and plus, I said, Chip, I said, there's 1,000 bands now that are doing that. I said, whatever we are, we can't be just one more of those, you know?
Well, and you say this is right around the breakup, because that double 7-inch thing, that's slower.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Sound of the Rain.
Well, that was leading more to what Rank and File was going to be. It was a strange time, because plus there was a, I don't know if you ever noticed this, Mike, but I always felt that there's a dynamic in a scene,
yeah,
and that you've seen a scene after a while, that especially once you become a part of it, and then if it starts happening for you, you reach a point where you know you can pull 200 or 300 people, you know, regularly, and you can become a pretty prominent, you know, the cock of the walk of that scene, you know, and there can be several of them, several cocks of the walk scene, several bands. I remember up in San Francisco, it was like the Avengers and the Nuns, and the Dills actually reached that status where, like, we were the band, you know, we were the band. This is right before the Dead Kennedys came out, like that next wave of San Francisco bands that actually took it all to a totally different level.
Romeo Void.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have mentioned them.
Oh, no offense to any Romeo Void fans out there.
No, it's just that I never thought of those guys as being part of that. Yeah. They're more like New Wave. New Wave.
It's hard to explain to people about those shades of contrast.
Yeah, but then
you had to be there to understand that.
But I think what happens is that if you don't actually get out of that scene, I mean, get out in the sense that you're pulling in a lot more different people than just the original faces. You know, the couple of hundred people.
I tell that people, the punk scene in those days was very small.
Yeah, it was very small. Yeah. But if things start to falter, then that can all get that can all just crumble out from under you really quick, and you've got no place to go. In the sense that, I mean, there's a point where everybody goes, where, like, you know, they followed their favorite band in little clubs for years, and all of a sudden their favorite band is playing big places, and you're going, who are all these people?
Yeah.
And that's when you stop going to see them, right? You're going, fuck it, they got
immersed.
Yeah, they got immersed. And but if you do something to irritate or piss off or rock the boat of whatever scene you're in at the time, and you haven't started pulling those other people in to take you you know, to take you out of that, you will get eaten alive.
And yeah, what was this word? Slag?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of heavy. Seem to be so small.
Yeah.
It gets kind of insidious, maybe?
Yeah, well, because I remember it reached the point that one of the reasons why the deal split up is that San Francisco got really toxic for us just because of some personal things that had happened. Our manager had quit or wasn't working with us anymore, and he was very popular in the scene himself as just a personality, and he would start coming to shows and like standing in front of us and going like this, and a third of the audience
Tony show a middle finger,
yeah, and a third of the audience would be going like, what's he doing that for? These guys are uncool. I had gotten in a couple of fights with real fights with a couple of people that were also scene favors, stuff like that. And like I said, we weren't breaking out of the scene. We were still in the scene. And so all of that stuff started to actually, you know, we started playing and people were kind of going like, you guys are assholes. Or you guys suck now. You're not any good anymore.
See, so, we were far away enough in Pedro, we didn't know about any of that.
No, the thing is that
you know what I mean? I look back now on it, and it was so good
that
we weren't, that even though it was very informal scene, we still were, there was distance between us and Hollywood and what was going on.
And
we just saw you guys as a great band.
Yeah.
And well, didn't care about the other shit.
No. Well,
I would read sometimes in interviews there were some heavy things coming down.
Well, the other shit would only happen in San Francisco. In L.A. it was still fine, and every place else, like up in Vancouver, in Portland.
Yeah, I was going to get to that because
but we lived in San Francisco.
The last recording is done in Canada, right? So you go up there to record, or you can go to move.
No, we never moved up there. We ended up playing there a lot because our last drummer we had, Zippy was from Vancouver.
Yeah.
And the Dills always did really well up in Vancouver. We were very popular up there. And the guy, what was his name? I can't remember his name. But the guy, Rogaletti Records, he was the guy who said, because you didn't sign contracts right back then. It was like, just put a single out, wait a little bit, then get a few more songs, pick out your two best, make another single, and it was about time for us to do another single. And so he said, hey, you guys want to I'll put a record out, and we went into a real studio. And
it's trippy. It was 2 7-inches with 3 songs. You didn't go and make a 4th song.
I don't know why, but we just didn't. Maybe we ran out of time or money or just didn't bother. Or the idea was to put 2 songs on one, you know, really cram it down on one side and just release it on 1:45
and do then it. Tiny sound.
Yeah, that would have been, it wouldn't have been.
No, it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's listen to one of those songs.
Yeah, you know when they play punk rock on that radio station, the guy comes on afterwards and goes, well, I don't know. Kiss song.
to do you better. And if you forget, you can get these of your life. But now you don't want me, then you'll be wasting your time. You got your problems and I got mine. But they do not make you live. You're living in fire. I'm away from earth. You might as well stay in your tank. No matter what you do, you're better.
It's Not Worth It by The Dills, live. You know what it says here, Tony? It says 1980.
No, The Dills were gone by 1980.
I know, but this is what it says.
That's when that was put out, right?
Let me
no,
see.
It says recorded live, Christy.
No, that was not. Dills,
so
it, Dills
if you get
ended,
this class
Dills,
war record, there's some erroneous
yeah,
information.
The Dills were gone by the end of 1979.
Okay, so it's bullshit. And it's got the first, that's Lee Joseph. Sorry, Lee, but... This is great, this picture here. Look at Chip. I mean, right? They're standing there.
Yeah.
So this stage is probably on the deck.
That's the Mabuhay. And that.
Oh, they came up on stage. Oh, yeah, the Rex.
Yeah, that's this is Danny. Danny from The Avengers. That's yeah. That's Will Shatter. I'm not sure who this is, but and that's Jimmy Wilsey from the Avengers.
Avenger bass player. Mm-hmm. Ended up guitar with
Chris Isaac.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sad trip. Yeah, getting up. So the Dills, the problem with the scene.
Yeah, and just feeling like it was...
Like you couldn't make other music and still call it the Dills. You're going to have to make a new band.
Yeah.
And in fact, with the cat from The Nuns.
Yeah, with Alejandro from The Nuns.
Yeah.
Chip had, I actually left doing any kind of music for, I sold my T-Bird and everything, sold all my stuff and moved to Portland, Oregon. Lived there for about a year, really miserable and unhappy.
Not playing any music.
Not doing any music at all. Chip had moved to New York to play with Alejandro and it actually started this band, Rank and File. Which actually, The Dills, The Nuns, we've gotten together before, and done like a project called Rank and File before. We actually did some recording, which sounded nothing like the Rank and File that came out later. But anyway, that's where Chip and Al had gotten a taste of playing with each other. And so when the Dills split up, Chip moved to New York to play with Alejandro, and. They kept the name Rank and File, started a whole new thing, with some country feel to it, but all sorts of different stuff. And they had a different bass player, a drummer, a bass player, and stuff like that. And they were actually touring, and they did like low budget tours, and they were coming through Portland.
Oh, so you saw the gig.
I saw the gig, and I basically got in the van with them as they were leaving. And
you weren't at the front of the stage?
No. and then I moved to New York, and we stayed in here for 4 months. And from there, Chip and Al and I moved to Austin.
Yeah.
Where we got Slim. And to actually kind of really put that band together. And
now the scene had changed, right? Some bands were starting to get signed.
Yeah, but see, I was not, Mike, at the time. You mean the scene here?
Not the punk scene, but the music scene.
Yeah, but
I'm starting to sign some. Did Dream Syndicate get a deal? And I mean, there was some.
Yeah, but I wasn't. See, but I wasn't paying any attention to that. We were living in Austin at the time, and we were basically concentrating on putting this band together because it wasn't. That band took a lot of thought, you know, and that was the first band too where. Unlike the Dills were more. A lot of times with the Dills, it was almost like we weren't a band. It's like a band, like, here's the songs, here's the set list, you play, you know, and then we're going to record, and then we're going to perform, and let's do it, let's have a career thing. The Dills were never that at all. The Dills were, it was more like an explosion. I mean,
Remember the last gig?
Punk rock thing.
Is the last gig an explosion?
Yeah, I think it was here in L.A. I cannot really remember.
Princess Hall?
I think so. It might have been. I can't really remember. Because the end, to me, the Dills had more like of a petering out thing than like an explosive ending. Okay. That's just my memory of it.
You're excited about this rank and file thing.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And we got to Austin. Chip and Al and I auditioned a bunch of drummers. It was just like the early punk rock days. Nobody wanted to play. The music was too strange, too weird to them.
Yeah, there was a thing called cowpunk that came later. In fact, one of the surf punk guys is like middle name in the ad, Scott Cowpunk Goddard or something.
Yeah, I see. I don't know about that.
We were on some bills with him at the Music Machine or some. And he was Scott Cowpunk Goddard. And then we got to be friends with this cat who had a band called Blood on the Saddle.
Right, Greg, Greg, yeah, yeah.
Was pretty mean guitar player. D. Boone really dug his guitarist. Yeah. And he had a stand-up bassist.
Yeah.
And
that was in the band.
A genre developed.
A genre developed, yeah.
And the rank and file wasn't aware of that because it was probably being formed, right?
Mike, I could not tell you. All I know is that we were in Austin putting this thing together, and we played a gig. Basically, got booked at this club in Austin based on the fact that Chip and I had been in the Dills and the Nuns. People thought they were going to get like a California style punk rock show.
Yeah.
Based on the pedigree, and we didn't. And we came and we played this stuff, and it was like, no, no, we're not, we don't want to hear this.
Not even in Austin?
No, especially not in Austin, because Austin was just getting into New Wave at the time.
Oh.
And they didn't want anything that had anything at all to do with country. And it was that, this is what, we don't want to hear this crap. You know,
we've heard a lot of it.
We grew up with it. You know, we're sick of it. And so we could not get a gig. And we basically, the only gig we could get was at this place called the Shorthorn, on the north side of town, and we got where we played every Wednesday, and it was me and Chip and Alejandro and Slim, and we would go there and play like three sets every Wednesday, and just basically build up a crowd of people who didn't have a clue as to like the Dills or not. They didn't care, you know, and from there we kind of went back into it, and by that time, it was like, it was just, you know, bringing people along. It was bringing people along. I remember it was sort of funny, especially looking at what happened with alt country later, but I remember it was funny when...
Alt country, that's...
It would literally be us, you know, after a gig, sitting around, and everybody's kind of going, this is so great, this is so cool, this is so cool. And you'd be putting on the usual, like a Johnny Cash record would play on the thing, or a Patsy Cline, all the standard stuff and stuff like that. And then Johnny Cash would go, then somebody would go, but fuck Willie Nelson, man. And we'd go, no, Willie Nelson is cool. It's cool. It's okay to like Willie Nelson.
Oh, what about Eagles?
Okay. No, never that. No country rock, actually. None of that stuff. And then we got that started, and then we went on the road and played, and came out to the West Coast, and you know, and it went back to the East Coast, stuff like that, and did really well. And we got signed accidentally to Slash, and we put that record out, and things really went well for us for a while. Yeah. But it was that we got signed. I say accidentally because the person who ended up doing our demo and producing that record, David Kahn, who went on to...
He's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Fishbone and the
Bengals. David went on to have a really, you know, lucrative and successful career.
Did something with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, exactly. But he had gotten signed by 415 Records to produce a band called the Red Rockers.
From New Orleans.
Yeah, from New Orleans. They were playing on that bill that night that we were playing on, and he walked in on our show and thought we were the Red Rockers. And so he was coming backstage.
Which were kind of like a Clash band.
Yeah. And he came backstage and was talking to us about, oh, I can't wait to do all this stuff. And then after like 5 minutes, it became obvious that he thought he didn't know that we were rank and file. I thought we were a different band.
Yeah.
And we said, well, you saw us, right? And he says, yeah, it's great. And he says, we said, we're not the Red Rockers. And he said, well, who are you? We said, rank and file. He said, how long are you going to be in town? We said, we're going to be staying over tomorrow, and then we're leaving the day after. And he goes, I want to record you while you're here. So we went, he got a little time because he was working as a staff engineer at the Automat recording studio up in San Francisco. Went in, did a few songs, and got them. They got to Bob Biggs because Dave Alvin and the Blasters had seen us, and they really liked us, and they had gotten signed to Slash. And so Dave kind of put the word in, and we got signed to Slash Records.
And you started the touring thing.
Yeah, then the next 3 years of your life, you know,
right.
Playing every night and all that stuff. Yeah.
And so how'd that adventure go?
What's that?
How'd that adventure
go? It was fun. Looking back on it, I wish I would have enjoyed it more than I did.
Bumming on it?
No, I wasn't bumming on the actual thing.
That was Bass Portland.
I was, what's that?
That was Bass Portland, right?
Yeah. I was pretty uptight back, you know, thinking about stuff. And I didn't think we were that good. I thought we could have been better. You know, I wanted us to work a little bit harder at what we were doing instead of kind of goofing off a little bit. And I think that when it came time to make our second record, I think that sort of, or when we were working up to make the second record, I think that that sort of thing, that's when it showed, you know, the fact that, you know, this is great, but you got to make your next record. And are you guys ready? And we weren't. But we had to make one anyway.
Which whole another dynamic versus scene politics. Now you're with the
this was the first
industry.
It was the first band I was ever in that was like a band.
Yeah.
You got set lists, you've got schedules, you've got, you know, be here now, do this, you know, you do your interviews before the show, you know, do the show, go here after the show, that sort of thing. You know, real tours, real, you know, real business people snorting coke, you know, behind doors and coming out with it hanging under their nose and coming up to you afterwards, you know, when you just got off stage and trying to have a beer, and all of a sudden these guys that, you know, haven't even listened to your record or even seen you are sitting there telling you how incredible you are, and you're going, it was real. It was the real band thing. But
so you did 3 years of that.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Just the same thing. It just kind of petered out. Business fell off. It just fell apart. Well,
you didn't have the Thunderbird.
No, I was playing a precision bass.
Yeah.
Big mistake.
No, that's a great bass.
Yeah, I had a 62 P bass that I bought in Austin. That was a really nice bass. Actually, the bass I made, the bass I used to record this album was a you know, those Fender Telecaster basses with the big fat humbucking pickup up front.
I had one of them.
Which is it's the worst sounding bass Fender ever made. And I remember the engineer, and I love the way it looks, you know, because it has that big metal square right there under the neck, and it's got the big long strings, and it's got the little old style Telecaster tuning peg head, but it's a horrible sounding bass, and that's the bass I recorded this record with, and I remember the producer just kind of going, that's basically the worst sounding. So it was like David Kahn just trying to get some good sound out of it.
What'd you use for an amp, SVT?
I ended up using an SVT. Because
in Dills, I didn't ask you about this, but because I'd see you play, you use a lot of different stuff.
Dills bass amp I always used was a Sun Concert bass.
Yeah, I saw
An 18-inch reflex.
Right,
thing.
Folded horn.
Yeah, and if I used anything else, it was like something I had borrowed.
Yeah, some of the other bands. I'd see another band playing the same amp.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I saw that a lot of bands sharing equipment.
Yeah, but with that, it was, I switched to a, I had a, I got another Sun head because I liked the one I used in the Dills so much. And then I got a really crappy enclosure made by a local Texas manufacturer who did, it just wasn't a very good sound. And so then I went to, I got an SVT. And that's, you know, they're just SVTs.
You stuck with that. Yeah. So, how did this... This didn't explode either.
No, it did. No, Rank and File had a really, we had a really, really nice ride for about a year and a half.
No, I'm talking about the end.
Oh, the end of this?
Fizzle out.
Yeah, it, no, it fizzled out too. It didn't explode. Yeah. It fizzled out when. Here's when it's not only the fizzle's done, but you hear the. And then the silence. We had done a tour in place, which is after our third album came out, and that album was awful. It was horrible. It was a horrible record. It's the one record I've ever made in my life that I'm ashamed of.
I mean, we're going to play the whole thing.
Yeah, right. The concept. But... And we toured on that record, and as
alternative mixes,
yeah, right, extended dance mix, and as what happens to a band that puts out a really, really, really awful album happened to us is that we were playing places that we had packed, you know, a year and a half before, and there was nobody coming. It was, and the handwriting was on the wall that it was just basically over, and. I mean, and inside the band it was over too. There was no. Inspiration. It was just gone. You know, it was gone. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation. I mean, have you ever been with a unit where you're just kind of going, this is through?
Yeah.
Once. I mean, obviously not the Minutemen. Cause,
no.
But anyway, the.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
But it's kind of being facing realness.
Yeah, it's facing the music. And I remember we were on this miserable tour. That was just bomb after bomb after bomb, and you know you're just kind of going, oh, I want to go home, and we ended up having a week off in New York, in between Purgatory and Hell, you know, finishing this thing off, and we had a week off, and. Chip and I had just gotten our publishing check, so we had some money. So we were having, you know, we were enjoying ourselves. And the rest of the guys had flown back home because these guys were married. The other guys in the band were married, so we flew them back home. They spent time with their families. And Chip and I were there just bopping around. We had some friends there and and had, you know, some dough to spend. And we're enjoying ourselves. And we went to our booking agent. No, it wasn't our booking agent. He was a guy. It was a friend of ours who was a booking agent that we, because, you know, we were thinking, well, maybe it's our booking agent. Of course it wasn't. We went and said, hey, you know, could you just see if there's stuff, something out there that's better, you know, than what we got, than what's happening? And he said, yeah, I'll see what I can do. And the gig he came back with was a tour that we could start after this one. We would have been opening, it was a college gigs, opening for Michael Stipe's Slideshow. Not Michael Stipe's side band from REM. Not REM, not Michael Stipe's side band from REM. Michael Stipe's Slideshow, where he was touring colleges with his photographs and stuff like that, and basically... And I took this in Amsterdam, and, you know, and Amsterdam's really interesting, and we had a great gig here, and here's Peter with his pants off. You know, that sort of stuff. And we were going to open for that.
Now, what year is this?
This is like 1986, or 87, 86, 87, and Chip and I just looked at each other and went, it's over. You know, let's stop this now. Yeah. And we told the other guys that, you know, this is through, we're through. And we came back to L.A. and formed Blackbird.
Yeah, right.
Which was, because we wanted to do something completely different. Completely different than
well, we're going to get to that. But Brother Mascot is spin cycle right now. Been a long time as a rock and roll. Been a long time as a digital. Let me get you back, let me get you back, let me get you back. Baby, where I come from. Been a long time, baby. A long time. Long, 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 long.
Cool.
Brother Matt, thank you for your spin cycle installment.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Buttressed with voices of our guests. Bob Starrs joined us. I didn't get to say hi to him. Hey, Bob. Thank
nice
you for
being to see you here. Listen to Tony's history.
Yeah.
Tony's history cool. lesson. It's yeah, righteous.
Part three.
But first, end of hour two. November 30th, 2008. Watch the Peter Show. Hold tight for hour three. November 30th, 2008. It's the third hour of the Watch the Peter Show. And continue on with Tony's journey through musical life. The Dills are behind him. Rank and File is behind him.
Now?
Now we come upon Blackbird.
Blackbird.
After Chip and I broke up, we stopped doing Rank and File. We came back and wanted to do something completely different. And so we came back to Los Angeles, where we were living by that time. And we had been, like I said, the Dills were like a very much a punk rock explosion thing. Rank and File, I love the band, but it was very much the part working in the music industry was a big part of it. And we had had enough of that, and we went for a complete the opposite.
We was like apprentice, journeyman.
And now
master. Right, now we're master. You might want to call it that way. Anyway, so what we did is we came back and we got a sound. We came up with a sound that was completely different from what we'd done before. Any kind of country type stuff and or punk rock stuff. And we played with a drum machine, which we were new at the time. But that's what we wanted. We wanted that sound. And it was just...
Don't have to deal with personalities either. Lose
no, no, you don't. And it was also and it was just a very free. I mean, for us, free. It was still songs, you know. It was still us writing tunes and stuff like that. But our approach to it was really different. And we liked the concept of the drum machine thing too. It was very It was a whole counter band thing.
Yeah.
Because rock. Rock music audiences tend to be really they're actually really conservative in a lot of the ways. I mean, even I am. Like if I go to see as a bass player, like when you go to see, if you grew up or you go to shows where somebody has a bass that you think is really cool, then all of a sudden there's a gig and they're playing something different. You know, even then it can rub you the wrong way. And anyway, people love to see, you know, if they hear drums coming off a stage, they want to see a drummer. And we didn't do that. Except for a while there. Once when we did some shows with Firehose, Mike Spann,
right.
We had a friend of ours, Claire. We asked her to be our fake drummer, and what she did was she borrowed a drum kit from KK, who was the old drummer from the Screamers, his gray drum kit, and we had her play it, fake it on stage, but not trying to fool anybody, just to have a human sitting there going through the motions playing drums on stage. When Claire first came over, I remember she said, well, can I come to your rehearsals? And we said, me and Chip, we said, no, you don't need to, you know, just because it's not important for you to rehearse. And she was a natural born show person anyway, show woman. So, We knew that was going to be a problem, and when we were actually doing the shows, I remember the sound man was coming up to mic the drums, and we said, "Don't put any mics on." And he said, "Well, what?" And we said, "She's a fake drummer. There's no mics. It's all coming out of the drummer." He said, "Okay." And so she would, and when she would play, she would play with the songs, but she wasn't trying to play like when you see somebody miming on TV to a track.
Right.
It was just like, and it was funny watching. I remember watching the audience because there would be, especially at a Firehose show, there'd be all these dudes up front, Firehose dudes, And they would be, you know, they would be crowding the front, getting ready for you guys to come on, right? And it would be, because you guys were players, you know, and George, and they were, you know, it's like, nobody's going to mistake George for a fake drummer, right? And so we would watch them, and about halfway through the set, you would see it start to dawn on these guys that, again, weren't there to really see us. They were waiting to see Firehose. That she's not playing drums. She's not. And you could see them like telling their friends, you know, it was loud, so you couldn't hear what they were saying, but you could see their faces contorting in anger or astonishment, and guy yelling over at his friend, like pointing, going, she's a fake. And then, of course, in between songs, and we didn't pay attention
to the man.
Yeah, we didn't normally stop a lot in between songs, but in between you could hear like these guys going, she's not playing, she's faking, and all this stuff. And then we say, well, this is our fake drummer, Claire, and it was like, they felt ripped off and strange, and so, because sometimes the concept does not get through. They wanted to see a real drummer. But anyway, that was a very Blackbird thing to do, very Blackbirdian. And Blackbird was a band that Chip and I had for, we had that band for a long time.
Yeah.
It was a real fun band. We made two albums, recorded some other stuff, and It was just a real fun band to be in, mostly because there were just absolutely no expectations for anything. It was just what it was. And there was a time when business people started actually to come around, because we actually started doing sort of well in town here, and we have this one song called "Time to Go," that is, it's a Blackbird version of a blues song, and it's about, when we would play it live, it would be about 11 minutes long, and it was just Chip playing this riff, and me singing, and no bass, and then the Chip's guitar break, and bringing the drum machine, then the drum machine stops, more guitar break, and it was like a signature song to the people that liked us, but to those that didn't care about us, it was like guaranteed to drive them up the wall. And I remember that we had a...
Good, let's play that song.
Okay. Now.
Thank you.
Okay, Tony, you were saying about the Shecky.
Oh, well, the Shecky came in and he asked if he could be our manager. And we said, he asked, did you have a manager? We said, no. He says, do you have any kind of management contract? We said, no. He says, do you want a manager? We said, well. And he said, well, could I, you know, maybe try out be your manager? We said, try, give it a try. Will you sign a management? We said, no. You know, just manage, try to manage something. And so one night we were playing Raji's, and
Raji's no longer because of the earthquake.
Right, and Raji's was a great fun place to play, but it was a real shithole.
It was. Do you know what? Before it was called that, it was called the King's Palace.
There's an even better name for it.
Yeah, and it had like puffy stuff hanging off
King
the
of
rope.
Wad, yeah, but it was. But Raji's was a blast to play anyway, and so we're playing Raji's, and he goes, "I've got it's." I'm making this night a showcase for you. And we're going, what? Showcase? He goes, what? And so we said, he said, yeah, I'm bringing some industry people down. We go, okay, bring industry people down to Raji's. All right. And then he goes, I want to ask you.
I mean, guys,
yeah,
yeah, it was miserable. And Tom sleeping in a sleeping bag in that office of his. Yeah. And then he says, but one thing I want to ask you, we said, what's that? He says, don't play the song Time to Go. And that was, but that's like waving a red flag in front of Chip and I. And we said, okay. And so so the first 30 minutes of the set was that song. And but that was the whole point of what, I mean, we were meant to be unmanageable. It was just that sort of thing, like, don't do it. Don't do it. Anyway, so, and we played Blackbird for a good long time, and Blackbird actually ended on a good note. It was we were just done with it, but it wasn't any sort of, there were no expectations that had fallen apart, so it was just a fun all the way through. It was a fun run.
And then you went on to Cowboy Nation.
Cowboy Nation, yeah. Which was another complete departure, because we wanted to get back into, at the time, we were listening to a lot of old-timey type music, like Tex Ritter doing cowboy songs and stuff like that. And we just went even further back and got some of the real folk-oriented stuff. And plus, I remember as a kid having the Johnny Cash Mean as Hell album, which was his cowboy album. It's a double album set. I think it's a great album. A lot of people would find it very strange, though, because it's a lot of Johnny Cash did like 3 or 4 different concept albums, and they're all fairly strange because when a country person does a concept album, they put so much of themselves into it because it's much more vocal oriented than, say, a rock concept album like Tommy or something. They carry a lot more of their character into it. They're doing it's like Willie Nelson doing Red Headed Strangers the same way, or he did three. Willie Nelson did Phases and Stages and Shotgun Willie, which are 3 separate concept albums.
Right.
And some are very weird. You know,
did a reggae album a couple years ago.
Yeah, but these were like thematically, you know, like thematically conceptual. Like one of I can't remember which one is. We were just talking to God, and anyway, that Red Headed Stranger, Mean as Hell, and stuff like that. And Chip and I said, let's try that. Let's take a genre music like cowboy music
and a drummer, Dennis Dug.
No, this was completely different from Dennis, because what Dennis was is actually Chip and I put together a little rock combo for a few months in between Blackbird and Cowboy Nation.
What was that called?
We never really had a name.
Well, what was on the bill?
I think it would be like Chip and Tony Kinman and Dennis Dug. Didn't go anywhere.
Like
it
was Bruce and
it wasn't as much fun as we thought it was going to be. No, not due to Dennis, but you know, it just
Dennis played with Dream Syndicate and Human Hands.
Yeah, yeah.
Is he still around?
Yeah, Dennis is still around. It just wasn't weird enough for us, though. And so we started doing this, and
had a drummer.
Yes, we had a drummer. It was Jamie Spidle. And she was playing a very minimal kit. She would play a kick drum and a hi-hat. Oh, yes, she really played. And percussion, like a tambourine or shaker or blocks. And the whole idea was to be absolutely minimal, to do these songs and strip them down to the bare minimum so that you could still follow the structure. And that's how we started, anyway. And although it fleshed out after, like the third album. And it didn't... Another interesting part about Cowboy Nation is that we wanted to play for the cowboy music audience, which we actually did. We started doing, because there is a cowboy scene that has absolutely no intersection between what we, you know, what we've been talking about and itself. And we would do shows here in Los Angeles, but they were like really small, and that wasn't our main thing.
Gene Autry.
Yeah, we would play the Autry. We would play the Autry.
The Cowboy Museum.
Autry Museum. We would play.
Which is great. It's got a place for black cowboys.
Yeah. Yeah.
A friend of mine was his archivist for his box set. Very interesting. Worked for him for years.
Gino.
Go into this warehouse, and he trusted him enough because he worked at that radio station. What was that, 101.9? We go in and just pick out what you want. And this guy's in country, actually, in front of the Rotters later. Now he's moved to Nashville, but it's pretty cool. Good man. Cowboy.
So you work in the cowboy circuit.
Yeah, we were doing that, and we recorded 3 albums, and a funny thing happened on the second after the second one, though. We recorded the first one for an album, a label in Australia, called Shock Records, and I cannot even remember how we got that weird deal. But it was one of those things where we have some friends in Australia, and some Australian record company calls up and said, "I heard you guys are working on something now." And we said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, we'd like to put it out." We said, "Well, don't you want to hear what he said?" "No." And so they sent us a budget. Chip and I bought some recording equipment and recorded the record ourselves, which was easy to do because it was so minimal. And got the record put out there. We own the masters. Got the record put out there. And had it put out here. And it did pretty well. Got the attention of this record company called Western Jubilee Records out of Colorado Springs, which is the big cowboy music label. And we recorded our second record for them, and which I think is our best album. And that record did very, very well on the cowboy thing. And the whole time we're playing this stuff, and but with a really different approach, because we would be playing bills where you would have three or four acts, because these were all festival type things, three or four acts, and each one would actually be trying to outdo the new Sons of the Pioneers. You know, it'd be like, you know, with the four part harmonies and yodeling and stuff. And it was nice, but everybody was trying to basically do that. And then you'd get the guys who would basically be, they would sound like folk singers, except it would be a horse.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Yeah, and then and the Cowboy Poets would be on there, and the Cowboy Poets were always excellent. They were excellent. These guys were uniformly excellent. They would be excellent anywhere. They would do their spiel. It was always good. But the music wasn't so good, and we would come out and we would slay them, because, you know, Chip and I would come out, we'd play with a little, but not Dills type energy leaping or thing, but you didn't, you know, but just like with a little bit of enthusiasm for what we were doing and trying to keep it more real. Because we were actually looking back further to the source of the music than most of the other people were, which it stopped at cowboy movie music, you know, Sons of the Pioneers stuff. I love Sons of the Pioneers, but that's what that stuff is. And we did a Gene Autry song, we did Back in the Saddle, but we did it our own way, and wrote most of the stuff ourselves. And plus, we do like folk ballads, or the real cowboy type ballads, in our own way. And we were doing really, really well. And here's what an interesting thing happened on the way to the third album. Western Jubilee, who is a record company, was the biggest distributor and producer of cowboy music, which it got in all the specialty stores, it got on all the, you know, all the genre type marketing, it had prime placement. And Scott was also the manager. Scott O'Malley, who was the head of the label, was also the manager of like some of the big, like Don Edwards and Waddy Mitchell, some of the biggest names in the cowboy genre field. He started getting calls from his distributors, his people, saying, "If you make us carry Cowboy Nation, we're going to stop carrying your entire line." And he just said, "Why?" And he said, "This is, we just don't want this. We just don't want it." And as Scott explained to us, is that that scene has been the way it's been for so long that nobody wants to, even though they're always complaining about that, you know, we're not bringing any new people in to listen to this stuff. But we were. I mean, we were doing that, but they didn't want it because it like was upsetting apple carts, and they basically threatened him, and we had to record our next record on a different label.
Damn.
And we're still good buddies with Scott O'Malley, because he just said, "I'm sorry, boys. This is what I do. This is my living. This is my life."
That's screwed up.
It was weird. It was a shock when Chip and I had, because we looked at it and said, "You know, we've been doing this for a long time, and this shit's still happening."
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like the music was as far removed from punk rock as anything we've ever done, and yet it was having the same reaction among
it's a human thing.
Yeah, the establishment. It was unreal. It was unreal.
Cowboy hat,
yeah.
Coat.
Yeah, I was playing a dobro bass on stage. Yeah. Like, what's that?
You were tweaking the formula?
I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was, except that some of these people felt threatened. Here's a joke. When Gene Autry died,
yeah,
the joke in the cowboy music scene was everybody move up one. Because that's how stultified it is,
right.
And, you know, and weird, and a band, a big band that these people tried to make a claim for their own was what's that band? Big
Parliament.
No, they were like a Western swing band that kind of I can't remember now. I want to say Big Balls in Cowtown, but that's the
Big Sandy.
Yeah. No. It was these guys are, they're like the hot band or hot. Anyway, this band I'm talking about, they came up and they're players. They're swing band, but like and vocals, but cowboy thing. They came up and just kind of completely blew past all these people, you know. So that's an example of how these fools just don't they just don't know what it is that they're doing a lot, you know. They screw with something that could actually help everybody. And they're just idiots. And the music we were doing was not. I mean, it was perhaps.
Did you bring some?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's listen.
Yeah.
The years they come and go. What once I did quickly, I barely can get done at all. Don't you know? Wherever I'm going, I'm going as slow I ride to be. Settle down, take it slow. This rough stream ride, I just can't ride no
So who was that you said that was referring to Bo Diddley?
When he died...
Hold on a second. That was Spooky by Cowboy Nation. Now, we're picking up on a conversation that was going on while that was playing about Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
And Gene Autry.
Yeah. And while I was playing Quicksilver when Bo Diddley died, thinking I always loved that Happy Trails record. Anyways, I heard an interview with George Thorogood, who owes everything to Bo Diddley, and Bo finally confided in that the Bo Diddley beat wasn't something out of the projects in Chicago or anything like that. No. He was trying to do, when he first started, to play a straightforward version of the Gene Autry song called My Jingle Won't Jangle.
I thought he was from Mississippi.
And could be. But East St. Louis, I don't know, whatever it was. But anyways, in his inability to play that song, he stumbled upon this beat. Because, you know, he just couldn't play that song, My Jingle One Jangle.
Yeah, he's trying to play along to a cowboy song.
Yeah, and so he ended up with that beat. And pretty interesting.
That people who don't know what they're doing
can be innovators.
Right.
That's right.
The old joke is...
they don't get the credit, but, you know. Sometimes they don't get the credit, but someone else takes that.
Yeah.
And runs with it. Or with the influencers, like the Velvet Underground...
And it was almost like exciting to know that you can still have that effect on people, you know. But anyway, Cowboy Nation made three records, and then Chip decided, this is just a few years ago, that he was through with it, and so for the first time since we started playing as kids together, we went our separate way.
Yeah, that's a trip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't get into, when you guys started, you had Jeff singing.
Yeah.
Jeff leaves, you guys sing.
Yeah.
And you've sang ever since.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It started off with Chip mostly singing, mostly because I just wanted to be the bass player. I wanted to be
the beginning of the Dills.
Yeah.
As I was wondering about when Rank and File you brought in later.
Yeah.
I should have asked it during that time, but it was going through my mind. But you end up singing a lot of Rank and File.
Yeah. Yeah, and now in Los Trendy I sing all.
Yeah, let's get to Los Trendy. Okay. So Chip quit with Cowboy Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start this band, Los Trendy.
Yeah.
Which I like. I got to see in Sun Valley. Tiny. Amps. Tiny drum set.
Boy kit.
That was for Chang on drums. That was a special presentation. That is not the real presentation. Tiny. Okay. You guys saw a special presentation for that evening only.
Yeah.
By popular demand. The Tiny Amps, Tiny
Sound. Also special about Los Trendy, you're not on bass.
No, I switched over to guitar because what happened is that I didn't really want to get... I didn't want to get a guitar player. You know, I played with Chip, I played with other people, and I thought, well, I'm going to learn how to play guitar. I had never learned how to play guitar. I learned some chords enough to write some songs and put some stuff together. But I never played guitar well enough to play it in front of people. And some might think I still don't. But the...
you play good.
But I... So I taught myself, and...
Pete has to say bye.
Bye-bye, Pete.
So long.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, you assume me.
Okay.
So,
I get Christy Wedge. I asked, I'm playing one night guitar.
Christy Wedge.
Yeah, and she says, can I... Bye-bye, Morgan. She goes, I want to play something. I said, well, I'll teach you how to play bass.
Yeah.
And so, taught her to play bass. She's left-handed. And at first, we started teaching her
bass,
right-handed. Well, yeah,
bass.
She got the Hofner, and we started learning right-handed. She said, well, I'm ambidextrous. And so, she learned how to play right-handed, and then finally, I just kind of went, you know, there's just a little bit of something not happening there. So, we got her left-handed and basically had to learn all over again. But she snapped to it, got good, and got...
Kay's left-handed, but she plays right-handed because she thought this hand was supposed to be the...
Yeah.
The fretting hand was...
Well, you would think that. You would think that. But it doesn't really work that way.
There's also anyone that's ambidextrous is left-handed. There's a reason a one-arm bandit is on the right side, because that's all you guys can do. Seriously, no one's supposed to be born left-handed. Something is awry. We'll save that for another.
Yeah, left is...
I did better with my left
hand. In Italian, it's sinister.
Yeah, sinister.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of people will whack with the metal ruler to write with the other hand, but not a good idea. Anyone has kids
right
up.
Means correct.
If anyone has just had kids out there, don't do it.
Or droid. Prince droid.
Droid.
A droid. Droid. Prince is what to write, right? Yeah, and...
Gauch for left.
Yeah, see? So there you go.
Ooh, bad. It's screwed up.
Yeah, and
more eugenics.
And we got... Yeah, but it runs in the family. How many left-handed people are in your family?
Yeah, I know.
Well, then three, go with it.
Yeah.
And my father was left-handed, but they changed him over to right when he was a kid.
See, so, but he has the gene.
So it would have been four. My mom was left-handed, and my littlest sister is left-handed.
Tony, didn't Blackbird have that dyslexic B?
Yeah, we had a flip B, kind of like a, there's also a some couture thing that does the B. Yeah, it's a, yeah, we did.
The left-hander notices that, because it's exactly the only way I could work with.
Yeah, and so, anyway, so we
that
put...
the letter D?
B.
Lowercase?
No, capital.
But lowercase D.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So he's trying to tie in left-handed with dyslexia and Blackbird.
Well, it's a Yardbird connection, actually, over, under, sideways, down. Everything's inverted, and...
Or now you can buy a right-handers can buy a Stratocaster with the neck flipped up like Jimmy.
Where'd you find, you got a real drummer, no fake drummer.
No fake drummer. This is Dion, or Lucifer Chang, and we got him through an actor friend of ours who, it was kind of funny the way we put this band together, because I was a bass player, so naturally I'm going to play guitar. The bass player is somebody who's never played anything before, and the drummer was a drummer who moved from Atlanta to out here to be an actor, but drummed back there and hadn't touched this drum in like years. So that's, you know, we put it together like that, and it's a lot of fun. It also has like a Blackbird type vibe to it, in the sense that we like to record and stuff like that. But I don't, as far as putting it out. I did a little interview like a month ago, and the guy was saying, "So when are you looking for a label?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, are you going to put this out?" I said, "I don't know," you know, because I don't have any plans.
Yeah,
I don't, you know. Because I just don't...
It's for the love.
Yeah, I just don't... I don't even know that anymore.
Earth, I left my copy at your house, and 5 minutes later, I'm like, I might never hear this again. I have a question, though. It seemed like this little Tinker Toy amps and all. The drummer seemed to be dovetailing, sort of, on your vocals. That evening. Is the record that way?
You mean singing along with me?
Yeah, singing along almost in a dovetail way. Not harmony. It was almost like they were merging together. Maybe it was the...
There's some parts where we sing almost like unison.
Yeah.
And there's some parts where he does sing harmony. But that's just the way we do it.
Well, it sounded really good.
Bob was digging.
You're an innovator. Uh-huh. You're an innovator. I want you to put your stuff in a time capsule and give the rights to me, and I'll put it out 20 years from now. Okay. And I'll send the royalties to your kids.
That's what he was saying at the gig. He says, Tony's always ahead of everyone.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about that. I think things are moving pretty quick in music nowadays. I can't keep up with stuff. I hear a lot of stuff nowadays. And the way I like to hear stuff nowadays, it's like we were mentioning during the, while Matt was mixing, was that the, having a chat, is that, you know, the stuff that you kind of hold closest to your heart is the stuff you grew up with, you know.
Sentimental.
Yeah, well, it almost sometimes it just sounds the best to you. You know, you're kind of going, yeah, it's
working
so much better. Yeah, it's well. There's a, you know, there's emotion. There's times and there's a time and place association. There's everything in
puppet
it.
Puppet strings tied to your feelings.
Yeah, and that's right. who's got the other end of the string though?
The prefrontal cortex.
Yeah,
like the scent of smell is. It takes you back to that moment that you tie it to, whether it was a broken love affair or whatever, and you're there.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you always
and all those emotions are back and vibrant, and of course,
yeah,
more.
Well, we had spent Thanksgiving out at Christy's sister's out in Corona, and Kim, her other sister, was riding with us, and her MP3 was, she had a Wishing and a Hoping, that song, Wishing and a Hoping, and that song came on, and I instantly remembered the very first time I ever heard that song in my life. I was living in South Carolina. And it was listening to that radio station, and that song came on, and the sound was just there, and it's still there, and you know, it's still that song comes on, and my ear can. I've heard that about people that are losing their hearing a lot of times, is that when they listen to music that they know, even though they can't hear most of it anymore, their memory is filling in. They can't listen to new music. They can't do that with new music. But when they hear something, they know their memory fills it in, and it's actually they're actually hearing it, even though there's no reason why they should be. But they're, you know, it's the I mean, there's nothing in their ear that's letting them hear more than what they're actually hearing, but their memory is plugging it in for them.
It's kind of Pavlov.
It's not Pavlov. But the way I like to listen to music, I like to listen to music like accidentally now. Like you'll be in a store and you'll hear something. Or be sitting in somebody's, riding in somebody's car with like an MP3, you know, that you don't know any of the stuff on. And then you're just kind of going, yeah. I remember the first time I heard the White Stripes.
You're curious.
Yeah, the first time I ever heard the White Stripes was in an art supply store in Silver Lake. You know, I thought they sounded like the Buzzcocks. Somebody said, you know, that was that first song, that first hit that was kind of sounded like the Buzzcocks to me. And I said, who is this? They go, this is the White Stripes. And I said, well, that sounds like the Buzzcocks. Of course, their stuff doesn't sound like the Buzzcocks. But I hear, you know, I mean, all this stuff I've heard after that. But I just like to hear stuff accidentally. I'm not really interested in that, going out and buying the record.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, it's just I just want to keep hearing stuff like that. It's kind of fun. We have this corner store that Chris and I go to in our neighborhood. It's run by these Sikhs. And I remember we used to go in there all the time, and they would play like Power 106 or something. They'd play like, you know, like urban stuff, you know. And I once went in there, and it was a slow afternoon, and they were playing like this Sikh spiritual music. Like,
oh, yeah.
And I said, this is your stuff, right? And he goes, yeah. I said, you should play this in your store. This is really good. And now they do.
Yeah.
And it hasn't, obviously it hasn't hurt their business, but I like hearing that when I go in there. It's really neat.
Exotic.
Yeah. We actually went to, but on the other hand, we actually went to one of the brothers who runs the store got married, and he invited Christy and I to his wedding. It was a Sikh wedding. And at the reception, they had these Sikh DJs, I guess, for the, you know, the community. There's a large Sikh community here. And it was just like, I guess it's the pop, you know, Indian pop music. It was like the same beat. It's the same beat you hear like at any American club. Yeah. With the singing over it, singing's a different language, and some of the chord changes will be different and stuff like that. But it's basically, you know, and you're just kind of going, this isn't like, you know, I wanted something a little more exotic, you know, I want to walk into a Sikh wedding and see, you know, swords and everything. But, and somebody singing this music or at least a recording of the music, but it was like, they wanted to dance. It was pretty funny.
You know, you've been around. What would you tell a young person about getting into music?
What would I say?
That's what Watt said.
I would say, do it. You can start off doing it just for fun, but if you want to do it any longer than most of your friends are going to do it, work a little harder at it than you think you have to, you know, work a little bit harder at it than you think you should have to, and also try to make it meaningful to yourself and somebody that's listening. Not necessarily serious or grim, but
vital.
Yeah. Try to do something that's not, you know. Try to do something where you're not going to try to fool somebody into thinking that it's something that, you know, it's not. It's difficult. I don't like to give advice to people except like generic encouragement, because if I don't actually like something, I would never want to be like your counselor that you started the show off with, you know, to go, I don't think you got it, you know, so don't waste your time. I would never, I never want to say that to somebody, even if I thought it.
No, but I was thinking of, you know, there must be some positive wisdoms out of all the hells. But maybe folks just got to go through those.
Hey, I knew all the stories when I started. Yeah. I'd read about him. It did not keep me from making, because you can keep yourself from making. The only mistake I think I ever actually made was indulging in sloth along the way.
Indulging in sloth.
Yeah, thinking that I'll just let this ride for 3 or 4 months and not worry about, you know, work so hard at it and just sort of and that was. But those periods where you do that add up, and that's because I was lucky enough not to get into drugs. I was lucky enough not to get into any into any situations where I got really screwed, you know, like money or like something like bad finger. I never got into any of those kind of situations. But you can, so sloth is my only mistake. But the thing is, you can't really control the mistakes of other people.
No,
and you can't. And some of the problems we had were the results of other people screwing up, not us. And the reflection that would have back on me is that you've got to watch out for that sort of thing, because there were signs, but you just ignore them while the going's good. But I would just say if you love doing this, do it, because that's the reason I'm still doing it, because I love it. I just love it.
Let's play some Lost Trendy.
Okay. I'm a Santa with a sack. Get away and leave no track. What I do has a long tradition. A lot of accusations, very few convictions. Bitter like a Jew, well, I'm clever and I'm cruel. I'm locking many doors, mirrors on the floor. Everything I want, but I'm always one more. Name of my games, act like I'm half insane. A runaway train, trying to explain existential pain that fills up my brain. Riding in from nation to nation. Getting into each and every temptation. Super Glam, that's what I am. Super Glam, that's what I am. Silver tights look good under colored lights. I'm thinking that I might treat you right. Gonna find an undiscovered appetite. Hey, young dudes, with your red, white, and quaaludes. You're beautiful and rude in the mood. I gotta say, I really like your attitude. Riding in from nation to nation. Giving in to each and every temptation. Super Glam, that's why I am. Super Glam.
With a sack, get away and coming back. What I do has a long tradition. A lot of accusations, very few convictions. Hit like a Jew, well, I'm leather and blue. Locking many doors, mirrors on the floor. Everything I want, but I'm always one more. Rattling from day nation to nation. Get an end to each and every little temptation. Superman, that's what I am. 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 That's what I am. That's what I am. That's what I am.
Watt from Pedro show. We started our final chunk of music. Not a lot of music, a lot of good spiel from Tony.
Cool spiel.
Thank you so much, Tony.
You're welcome, Mike.
But that was Super Glam from Los Trendy, or Los Trendy. Lo siento.
How'd you get that name?
Yeah.
Christy thought it up. We were discussing names, and all the good ones have been taken, like the Dills and Blackbird, Rank and File. And
the Pity Fur.
Yeah, the Pity Fur. No. Well, what it was is that we were sitting and I don't know how we got Trendy, but we got Los Trendy by the thing about, imagine it was like a DJ on like a Banda station, Spanish Banda station, going like, Los Trendy, you know, one of those things.
And yeah, because you bring in the...
Yeah, with the echo and everything. And plus the band is not trendy. We're not trendy at all.
Well, that's the thing.
You're
always in the antithesis.
So it's ironic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we heard Duck Missile Freak by the Yellow Gang. Rocklets Idiots Theme Part 2 by Rocklets Idiots. And finally, Ivy by Hideki Kaji. Tony...
Yeah.
Christy.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Talia, make another repeat. Bob.
Thank you. Of course. In the background.
Brother Matt. Aiden Abedin.
Thank you, Matt.
Awesome. Nice to have you guys here.
The Watt from Pedro show.
I've always wanted to have you on my show. I mean, we're almost 180 shows, and finally, I get Tony Kinman as my guest.
Have me back, and I'll interview you.
Okay. I'll be here now a lot. Thanks so much, though, and good luck with Los Trendy.
Thank you, Mike.
I can't wait till you play again. I had to miss your last one because I was playing. So anyway, it's been the November 30th, 2008 edition of Watt from Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.
That's right.